right. Wednesday at 5 p.m. And I want to thank Jesse Ventura. I am so happy to know that he is listening right now. It's fantastic. I'm glad he's a fan.
You know who also listens? Eddie Money.
Yeah, all the time.
All the time.
Every show. Wednesday, as I said, 5 o'clock. Tom Ryan here with my wife, Heidi Morales Ryan, for an hour of American Hit Radio. We're here every Wednesday and Friday.
America.
Yeah. American Hit Radio. 5 and 6 p.m. We got an hour to kill here, and I want to have some fun with it. What we've been doing lately is running our way through what we are now calling the top 500 of the top 40, meaning I picked with Heidi 500 albums from the year 1964 to the present that are meant to represent the 500 best albums that have made the album list of the top 40, according to Billboard, between now and then. We started this by doing a count of 500 alternative albums, which is incredible fun, and that's really the point of the book that I'm in the process of working. But since books take forever to write, I thought it would be fun maybe to spend some of that time also by listing the 500 great albums, because I've got to have perspective here from the non-top 40 to the top 40. They sort of balance each other out. So since we already did a good number of the non-top 40 albums, now we're switching around and we're going back to top 40. And right now we are at a point in time that would bring us to May of 1964. This is album number 8 in our top 500 of the top 40. Number 8 in our series of 500, if you're following me. And the album we're going to be covering today is entitled England's Newest Hitmakers, The Rolling Stones.
Wow.
Imagine a day when the Rolling Stones could legitimately claim to be England's newest hitmakers.
That's, I don't know, a long time ago.
That's how much time has passed, right? It's over 50 years later, they can certainly claim to be England's oldest hitmakers.
Wow.
And right now, they probably can't claim to be the newest anything. But this is where it all began, quite honestly. This is also the point where American kids begin to develop an inkling about our own culture, oddly enough. You know, not because we suddenly realized that like Muddy Waters and Slim Harpo were geniuses. It's more because, you know, the Rolling Stones played music that was written by people like Muddy Waters and Slim Harpo. And, you know, and because the Rolling Stones covered their music on the heels of Beatlemania, American kids were obsessed with everything that was coming out of England, even recycled Americana. So basically, you know, fans of the Rolling Stones appreciated this album, probably because to them it represented some awesome new English sound.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, in truth, all that the Stones were trying to accomplish was to record passable versions of songs.
They wanted to sound authentic.
Right. That they wanted to sound like their heroes. They were just hoping to basically do a nice representative version of it, not sound like English wantabes, a bunch of wannabes. It wasn't a really high goal that they had set for themselves. It was rather modest. Well, to put it very simply or succinctly, or to even understate it, they succeeded on their own terms, and the imaginations of the American kids basically did the rest of the work for them. This album has essentially one original song on it, if you don't count the instrumental, which is sort of a ripoff of another song, which we'll get into as we get there. So an album with 12 songs, essentially 11 of them written by other people, says a lot about what the Stones are at. They weren't even able to write their own material because they weren't thinking that they were going to ever be
that
sort of
writers.
A band yet.
Yeah,
they were basically just fans of American blues. Actually, American blues, but most essentially American rock and roll, really, because Chuck Berry, you can't understate how much of an important role Chuck Berry's played in the history of the Rolling Stones. It's in one way or another, I think I can honestly say that Chuck Berry seems like he's responsible for directly about 10% of their material and indirectly maybe for half of it.
easily.
Even in songs that aren't Chuck Berry songs, in a sense, because of the way it has influenced
them. They're just Chuck Berry-esque, the other ones.
Right. Well, when this album came out in America, it also coincided very closely with their first album in England. So the English album and the American album in this instance actually manages to be very similar to one another. The American label does not trash the record, as much like as we were discussing with the Beatles.
Right.
There was one difference that the American label did make. The Stones had out a new single. It was their version of a Buddy Holly tune. And it was, since it was the hit single, America thought it would be a good idea to put the hit single on the album as the lead-off track. So they took one song off and they added the single as the first song. So let's kick off the album with that song that was the single at this point in time for the Rolling Stones in the spring of 1964. Here's their version of Not Fade Away. That was a quick one. That's when hit singles could be less than 2 minutes long.
I know.
Clocking in at a minute 48
that's
there.
That's good. Don't mess around.
No, exactly. Yeah, I kind of miss those
point.
Days, to be honest.
Make your point.
A couple cool things, bit of fun facts about this. I always wondered about this when you looked at the songwriting credits for Buddy Holly songs. They're almost always credited to different names. They never say Holly, and I'm like, why? You know, they always say like Petty and I think it's Petty Hardin. And if his name is Buddy Holly, what's this Petty Hardin? Well, Hardin was the name of the guy. Charles Hardin was the guy that owned the recording studio where it was recorded. So as a producer, he often basically had his name added to songwriting credits. And it turns out Buddy Holly's name, basically, he did all of his publishing under his first and middle name, Charles Hardin.
Oh.
So that explains that. So
that
yes,
does.
They are written by Buddy Holly, but they sort of read funny. Anyway, this track was the Rolling Stones' first single release in the United States. And interestingly, the original B-side was the Beatles track, I Want to Be Your Man. Since the Stones couldn't write their own material, they were getting material supplied to them at this point in time by the Beatles. And that's where that song ended up, as the B-side here in America. Actually, it ended up on the B-side for a pretty funny reason. The original B-side was a song called Stoned, and America wasn't going to have that. So it was immediately withdrawn and replaced with I Want to Be Your Man. Meanwhile, track two on the album is a song that has been covered by, check this out. This is rather funny when you think about it. I mean, it's so many people, I can't name them all. But let's just say that this song has been covered by Bing Crosby and Depeche Mode.
Wow.
By Chuck Berry and Asleep at the Wheel. It's hysterical. By The Replacements and Natalie Cole. or Nat King Cole, who I think had the most famous version, perhaps until the Rolling Stones came along with their own, of this tune to Bobby Troup's cross-country trip when he figured he was going to become a famous songwriter, when he figured the way you get, the only way you're going to get well-known in this country, he figured, was I got to drive out to Los Angeles. So he set out from Chicago to L.A., and the way to get there was Route 66.
Take my way, that's the highway, that's the bend. I get your kicks on Route 66. Well, it winds from Chicago to LA. More than 2,000 miles all the way. I get your kicks on Route 66. City looks so pretty, you'll see. Amarillo and Gallup, New Mexico, Flagstaff, Arizona. Don't forget Nona, Big Sam, Moscow, St. Bernardino. I want you get hip to this kindly tip and go take that California trip to get your kicks on Route 66. So pretty, y'all see. Amarillo and Gallup, New Mexico, Flagstaff, Arizona. Don't forget Nona, Big Sam, Moscow, St. Bernardino. I want to get him to this kindly tip and go take that California trip. Get your kicks on Route 66. Well, get your kicks.
Great rock and roll version. And by the way, that's, you know, it was Nat King Cole who I believe had the first huge hit version after Bobby Troup with that song.
Oh.
But in a very, very different arrangement. What is funny is what I said earlier about Chuck Berry influencing 10% of their material directly and maybe the other 50% indirectly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that song was recorded by Chuck Berry. And his arrangement is almost
identical to that
I
one.
Mean, right. It's obviously, yeah. The Stones were just basically playing the Chuck Berry version of the tune.
Of course.
It was, they did it very credible. But like I said, you've got to, this was essentially a modest album. It was just a bunch of English guys.
It was doing a tribute to the people that they love.
Trying to sound like their heroes. And it became all this. You know, the one band that still is around, Keith Richards, still with us, Mick Jagger, still. It's amazing. Amazing, really. Out of the original members, the only one we lost was Brian Jones. That's
pretty
wild. It says something.
It does say something.
Yeah, considering
about the miracles
of
science, perhaps. But
right, right. I mean, very few bands had a reputation for being more, crazy and deep into dangerous lifestyle than the Rolling Stones for almost their entire career, but they're the ones that are still standing. I greatly respect that. Now we're talking about basically what I said, the things that inspired them. Now this next track is a Muddy Waters song written by Willie Dixon. Willie Dixon was the house bass player at Chess Records. And as such, he was in charge of basically arranging an awful lot of the recording sessions and providing a lot of the artists with material. So Willie Dixon is the guy that pretty much was writing a lot of the hits for Muddy Waters, who could also write his own, but Willie Dixon certainly helped fatten him out. Did the same thing for people like Howlin' Wolf. Willie Dixon, a very, an astoundingly prolific songwriter. And he was really especially good at basically making the blues sound interesting beyond the standard fare of what you might have expected it to be otherwise.
Right.
You know, really great for like what the electric blues became. Willie Dixon deserves a lot of credit. And here are the Stones. Basically, well, these guys were the Stones' absolute heroes. When they came to America, one of the first things that they ended up doing was going to Chess Records.
Oh, yeah. That's one of their fantasy things.
Exactly. In fact, as we move forward, that when they recorded their second album at Chess Records, they got to meet their heroes. They met Muddy Waters. And that was where their sound furthered
right,
and where
he,
they
like,
felt that they...
Right, wasn't he working in the hallways or something?
They basically, yeah, they were hanging out. They were there while they were recording. So, and this added to their own sense of strength about the success for what they were attempting to do, building up their own sense of self-confidence, which is why they eventually were able to write better songs. I'm convinced of that. Meanwhile, though, as I said, as they are just at this point in time, English kids trying to basically sound like good American music, here they are covering a Muddy Waters A-side called, Muddy Waters actually called it Just Make Love to Me. Stones actually called it the way that it was sung. I Just Want to Make Love to You.
Mm.
They definitely put the Rolling Stones spin on that one by riffing it up to about, sounded like you played the Muddy Waters records at at the wrong speed. We're playing our way through the Rolling Stones' very first album called England's Newest Hitmakers, which I've got my original copy of here. It's falling apart. I got the vinyl version of it.
Because you're old.
On London Records. It's kind of cool, though, to note. You know, we've played three Beatles albums already in this series. This is number 8. 3 of the 8 have been Beatles albums already because we started in 1964 and the Beatles obviously started out with a huge bang. And here's the Rolling Stones, the first English band to follow them out of the gate on the album tracks, you know, on the album charts, I should say. But unlike what happened with the Beatles, the American branch of Decca Records, you know, which is ironically was called London Records, did not muck up the original album too much.
As I said,
they literally just yanked one song off, a song called Mona, I Need You Baby, which is a Bo Diddley track. And that kind of went into limbo to make room for the first track that we played, Not Fade Away. Now, if we had time at the end of the show after we played the album, I would normally play that track, Mona, to make it complete. But later on, as we move forward, that song did end up on an American album that we'll be covering.
So we're not going back, kids.
We're not going that way, right? Exactly. We'll save it for later. We'll get there, though. Oh, the other thing that's very interesting is that the exact opposite of the Beatles. I mean, as the Beatles' career went to, developed and eventually the CDs came out, as we all know now, it was the British albums that provided the CDs that we all now know and love by the Beatles. The American albums are completely obsolete, as they should be, really, because they were ridiculous. The exact opposite happened with the Rolling Stones. The Rolling Stones' first album, called Rolling Stones Number One, is out of print on CD. If you want to get the Rolling Stones' first album, it's this one, called England's Newest Hitmakers.
That's what you can get?
That is the CD that is in print now. So that's rather interesting.
Well, eventually they're going to stop printing CDs altogether.
Yeah, probably.
Because kids today don't care.
I know. I'm stuck in the past when I talk about vinyl and 45s. And, you know, I think of CDs as being contemporary to some extent, but I won't miss them very much. I don't, you know, for what it's worth myself. But anyway, this next track on the album, there's not much I can say about it. Almost nothing, really, to be honest. This is like just how deep the Stones went. They were pulling songs, some of them rather obscure. And I can't trace this one. It's credited to writers Hurren and Calvert. It's called Honest I Do.
Don't you know that I love you? Honest I do.
Well, that wasn't too hard to find out. My mental block has been lifted on this now because as I'm listening to it again, I'm remembering that I know a version of this song with Tina Turner singing it.
Oh.
And then I'm remembering also that when she did it, it was a Jimmy Reed song.
There you go.
So it's one of, apparently I've got all three versions on my iTunes and I didn't realize they were all the same song. And it's because they have different writing credits. Like, for some reason, the Stone credits it to Hurren Calvert. I have no idea who that is. I believe it's a Jimmy Reed song. I believe he wrote it, but don't know for sure in that regard.
So it's still shrouded in a bit of mystery.
Regarding the writing credits, absolutely. But this much I will say, it probably first appeared as a recording under Jimmy Reed's credit as the artist. And I thought he would be the songwriter. And then I know Tina did a version of it, and here's the Stones version of it, too. Now, I mentioned that there's one original on the album. Well, this technically is an original, although it's an instrumental, and they credit it to Felge,
which is a made-up name.
Yes.
Whenever like the Stones like made stuff up in the studio, they would credit it usually to Nanker Felge, some goofy name for like the faces that they would make at each other. But, you know, they were kids. So it was like them just being silly. And all that this is them jamming instrumentally on the chord changes for Can I Get a Witness, the song that was made famous by Marvin Gaye. So if you listen to it, you're going to hear basically Can I Get a Witness without any lyrics. And they're just, you know, basically vamping on it and soloing over it. And to make it really obvious, they entitled their version, Now I've Got a Witness. Now I've Got a Witness, the instrumental track from the album called England's Newest Hitmakers. I got to be careful when I pick the album up. It's so old that every time I pick it up, the vinyl falls out the bottom.
It.
I'm going to end up damaging
you're
gonna the record.
You're going to lose it, man.
Now, when they were recording this, I think this was recorded over about 4 or 5 days. Keith was objecting to some of the things that were on here, saying they were actually, you know, demos. And they, you know, it was just put onto the album because they didn't have enough material. I would imagine that instrumental track is a good example of what would have been considered a demo because it's half of a track. You know, it's half
sorry,
of a track.
Sorry, kids.
Just the instrumental, and maybe even Honest I Do because it's not exactly. I wouldn't consider that.
They could have released
it later with
lyrics.
Right. Exactly. But while they were recording it, music royalty was showing up in the studio for one reason or another. Phil Spector,
oh boy,
had been there for some of their recording, as was Gene Pitney. They were apparently both around when they recorded this track, and Gene Pitney gets credit for playing piano on it. Phil Spector gets credit for adding some maracas. And rather interestingly, he also gets songwriting credit.
Oh, my goodness.
Somehow. I guess Spector says...
He always got that.
I'm on it. Yeah. I'm not going to let you release that if I played maracas on it unless you give me songwriting credit.
Wow.
So this is credited to Felge Spector. It's called Little by Little.
Last night, baby, betray you in my car. Girl, I
man, these songs are short. But that's how side one ended.
Yeah, these are not bathroom songs.
No. It's funny. There's only one song on the album that goes over 3 minutes. For side two, as I said, the Stones are going deep. They actually pulled a Slim Harpo tune. Pretty cool one, too. It was a song that was originally the B-side of Slim Harpo's single. He released a song called Got Love If You Want It, and I'm a King Bee was on the B-side.
Oh, yeah.
But it was I'm a King Bee that was getting all the attention. Did you know that he was from Baton Rouge, Louisiana?
No, I didn't.
I did not either. I thought he was a Chicago dude all the way, but apparently he's from Baton Rouge.
He's probably from Clinton.
Hmm.
You know, outskirts of Baton Rouge.
Perhaps. But he's on Excello Records, and that was a Baton Rouge label. And the names of the band members kind of look like one of them is Etienne.
Oh, okay.
You know?
Yeah.
So you got that Cajun that sort of a flavor to that. So I was like, oh, look at that. It's really not a Chicago thing. It's more of a Louisiana thing on the original track.
But how about that?
Here's the Stones doing their version of Slim Harpo's tune, I'm a King Bee.
Well, I'm a King Bee, buzzing around your hive. Well, I'm a King Bee, baby, buzzing around your hive. Yeah, I can make honey, baby, let me come inside. Well, I'm a king bee, want you to be my queen. Well, I'm a king bee, baby, want you to be my queen. Together we can make honey the world has never seen. Well, buzz a while, sting it then. Well, I'm a king bee, can buzz all night long. Well, I'm a king bee, baby, can buzz all night long. Yeah, I can buzz better, baby, when your man is gone.
Funny, at some point in his career, Mick Jagger was commenting about that song, and he goes like, what is the point in listening to us doing I'm a King Bee when you can hear Slim Harpo do it? I love the honesty of that.
Well, you gotta love that for sure.
And you know, quite frankly, it's true. I mean, this album it's a very good album. I love it. And it's so amazing as far as what it stands for, because it's so bizarre that this album had such a huge impact on American culture. Because it's just a bunch of English kids basically playing through some American blues, but it's what freaked us out. I mentioned that Chuck Berry was like, what was the comment? 10% direct? Here's them doing a Chuck Berry song. They're on the very first album. It's them doing Carol.
Swing a little, go away. on the highway, that's a long ride. You park the car in the open, you can walk inside. A little cutie takes your hat and you can thank a man. Cause every time you make the scene, you find the joint is jammed.
Thing when you think about it, but I'm curious, I don't know if I could even say it properly. I wonder if you would agree with me, but it seems that just because the Rolling Stones like covered these songs and the way that America reacted to them, despite the fact that the Stones were not trying to do anything, you know, incredibly remarkable, we heard it as something remarkable. And it, I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's sort of this, their sound of the doing these songs had a more profound effect on the way that rock and roll ultimately developed in a lot of ways than the original versions of these songs did. I think more people like tend to emulate like what the Stones were about in that sense than what Chuck Berry was about. That's pretty amazing. It's kind of weird and convoluted. But I think that's what America ended up doing. Simply because of the way that that we had neglected. I agree, really, quite frankly, because racism was so prevalent in our culture.
Yeah, that's exactly all had to do with.
Definitely.
Kids weren't allowed to listen to black
right,
or
for
race
the,
music.
For really the entire length of the 20th century up until this point in time, 1964, when civil rights were just beginning to begin to break through, white people simply were not exposed to black music. Kids probably weren't allowed to listen to it. So to hear white English kids, it was really the first opportunity that anybody would have had, and it had that profound of an effect. And maybe also, in a lot of ways, indirectly, had a tremendous amount to do with the whole ability for that cultural gap to begin to become less wide. Because all of a sudden, when you've got, you know, the whole cultural divide that was beginning to get smaller in 1964, you could maybe credit rock and roll in some small way for saying it is possible that music made it a little bit easier for black and white culture to mingle. Oddly enough, there were albums like this by the Rolling Stones, like America's first taste of it, really, for kids. I'd mentioned there was one original song on the album. It's also that one song that is the longest song on the album. It's actually pretty long by the standards of the rest. It's twice as long as some of those. It's 3 minutes and 47 seconds in length.
Whoa, epic.
Right. It was a single, not a particularly good one. You're going to hear how, Keith Richard and Mick Jagger at this point in time are still struggling to find their own identity. But they're no Beatles, but it's a start. The song is called Tell Me You're Coming Back.
I want you back again. I want at your love again. I know you find it hard to reason with me, but this time it's different. Darling, you're saying you gotta tell me you're coming. Tell you, but you didn't want to know. This time you're different, and determined to go. You gotta tell me you're coming back to me. You gotta tell me you're coming back to me. You gotta tell me you're coming back to me.
See that, you know, there's a lot, it's a good effort. What we know of the Stones now, I mean, obviously that song pales in comparison to their hits in just like maybe 1 year from this point in time, actually even less than that. But that this is where their songwriting skills were just beginning to get honed. And Tell Me is one of their earliest attempts. It's kind of funny. I mean, as the story goes, it was, you know, their manager, Andrew Lou Goldham, basically was trying to figure out ways to capitalize on the band in every way possible. And he basically knew that there wasn't a very big future for if the band was going to lose all the songwriting royalties by doing nothing but cover songs on their albums. What was making the Beatles rich was that the Beatles were writing all their own material. And Andrew basically said, all they're going to be doing by paying all your royalties to, quote, middle-aged blacks from America, it limited the appeal to teenage audiences. So it was, you know, Oldham who would sort of like try to lock Mick and Keith into rooms together to get them to write. And he even said that their, you know, their first efforts were, quote, soppy and imitative, which they were. quite honestly. But, you know, that's like I said, it's the beginning. And that's why on this album, there's only one original song credited to Jagger Richards. And we just heard it. Tell Me You're Coming Back. Like I said, you're listening to American Radio. Heidi Ryan and myself, Tom Ryan, here from 5 until 6, Wednesdays and Fridays doing this. Well, we're counting our way up through a list called, well, we're calling the top 500 of the top 40, 500 of the best albums. I'm going to say best, not even the most important. I'm really basing these upon my own personal idea of their bestness. Yeah, I'm not going to worry about what was number one for the longest time. I could care less about that.
Good.
I'm more interested in, you know, the album's quality and its ability to last beyond its release date and to still have some significance. And that's what's basically caused me to choose all of them. And so far, we've covered eight. This is number eight in our list that will eventually total 500. The album is The Rolling Stones, England's newest hitmakers. And we've got three songs left to go. We played the instrumental version on side one, as I said, was credited rather selfishly to Felge, as though they could claim some writing by playing the song without the lyrics. Here's the exact same song, this time sung by Mick Jagger, and credited, as it rightly should be, to the Holland Dozier Holland team, them doing their version of the Motown song, Can I Get a Witness?
If you try, you can make it. If you try, you can make it. If you try, yeah, yeah, you can make it. If you try,
time you had to fall. Don't you know sometimes you wanna cry? Don't it make you feel so bad sometimes you wanna lay down and die? Yeah, you can make it if you try. If your baby treats you wrong, don't run around being a fool. Remember, my friend, everybody can win. 'Cause you know sometimes, sometimes you got to lose. You can make it. They always told I could make it if I try. I'm gonna make it if I try. Yeah, yeah, I'm gonna make it if I try. If you try.
Well, in this instance, that song title said it all for me. I played two back-to-back because I figured that if I did that, I could make it if I tried. Because I got one more song to play, and we almost used up our hour. That track, by the way, was originally a hit for a guy named Gene Allison. Again, it shows how the Stones were going deep, getting fairly obscure. This is like a cool. This is what everybody, the coolest guys in England, were buying obscure American 45s to do versions of. Because nobody else would know the song. They'd get it, they'd learn it and play it. Like, wow.
I mean, look at Led Zeppelin. They even tried to take writing credits.
Yeah, because like, nobody's going to know this.
No one's going to know it.
And that was on Willie Dixon songs, too. Speaking of Willie Dixon. But anyway, Gene Allison had the first hit with that. He was actually at one point in time singing with the group called the Fairfield Four, who were still putting out records, American Gospel. Well, that brings us down to the last song, a song that basically... So we just got done covering like that whole Stax thing. Rufus Thomas was one of the biggest stars of our, we did our Stax series on Fridays about a month or so back. Here are the Stones doing their version of Rufus Thomas's, I believe it was his biggest hit, Walking the Dog. And that's how the album ends. Take care, everybody. We'll be back Friday with the How Music Changed series, and we're going to cover Simon and Garfunkel, part two.
Bye-bye.
Baby back, dressed in black. Silver buttons all down her back. Hi-ho, tips her toes. She broke the needle and she can't slow. Walking the dog. I'm just a walking the dog. If you don't know how to do it, I'll show you how to walk the dog.
Rice Krispies.